And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Ussery, and I'm happy to welcome journalist Joe Hagan to the program today. Today's episode is looking at Joe's biography, Sticky Fingers, The Life and Times of Jan Winter in Rolling Stone magazine, which is published by Knopf. Joe, in the afterword of the book, you talk about how Jan Winter approached you to write his biography. Did he ever tell you why he chose you?
Well, I inferred it from the fact that we'd already been talking about me coming to work at Rolling Stone magazine. In the kind of run-up to all this, I'd written a couple of freelance pieces for him in Rolling Stone and one in Men's Journal, another magazine he owned. And he showed a lot of enthusiasm for a couple of other pieces I'd written, one about Nina Simone. I wrote a piece about Nina Simone. And I'd also written a profile of Karl Rove, the Republican political strategist, which he really liked. And the real thing was, is he had just moved up to a kind of a country estate outside of New York City. And I happened to live in the area. And I think what he was thinking was, I'll just spend my weekends in my country estate talking to my biographer, which he began to refer to me as. I think a lot of it had to do with a feeling of comfort that he could spend his weekends with a writer that he knew could string a sentence together and get maybe control me too a little bit, you know, have somebody who was within his orbit and who he felt like would tell the story the way he wanted it to be told.
But it's not an authorized biography.
But, well, that was the key for me, was in the kind of – when he asked me, of course, I was flattered somebody would ask me to write his biography, a guy of this, you know, iconic magazine, really important guy. But he had a reputation in the business as being mercurial and kind of a bit of a pirate, you know. He'd fired a lot of people over the years and, you know, I wanted to be careful. And as it turned out, there were two previous attempts at the book that didn't work out. And so I told him, well, let me think about it, Jan. You know, thank you. This is an incredible offer, but I got to think about it. So I went to investigate a little bit what happened with these other books. And eventually I told him, listen, I'll do it, but it has to be independent. You know, I will not write an authorized book. And the reason is I already had a career as an investigative journalist. And to write an authorized book just would have been kind of forfeiting my credibility, to be frank, because authorized books are generally not good. So we negotiated it, and it took some time. He was resistant at first, and eventually he realized, well, I'm going to get this done. I have to do it this way, and that's how we did it.
And this is unlike the control he gave to many of the stars who had interviews in his magazine where he gave them editorial control on it.
Well, it's good that you bring that up, because he wanted to kind of see at what level I was willing to bend those rules too. He thought, oh, come on. You know, I give Mick Jagger editorial control, you can give me editorial control. It's fine, you know. And that's just not how I wanted to operate. And I knew if it was going to be a really good, spicy, excellent, true story, it had to have all the bars off, all the holds off. You know, and you had to be able to write it as it was. So I got that from him, and then we proceeded, and it was exciting.
Did he stay engaged with you during the entire process?
Absolutely. Well, listen, he's a man of formidable ego. Let's just put it that way. And he loved talking about his life. And I don't think there was a lot of people in his immediate orbit who were asking him. You know, of course, I was completely interested. And since I was doing research along the way, I had a lot of specific questions for him and was really kind of mining his memory. And he enjoyed it. You know, he enjoyed kind of getting into it. And in fact, a lot of times I had to tell him no when he wanted to meet all the time. And eventually I was like, listen, I got a lot of other work to do on this book. I can't meet you every weekend. And he wanted to do it constantly. I think part of it was he wanted to keep a tight rein on me and make sure that the story was being told his version, right? So it was a dance that you do, a biographer and a subject, a living subject. It's very complicated writing about a living person, because on the one hand, you're doing all this research that's telling one story, right? I interviewed 250 people. I mean, I spent a year in an archive, very deep archive of his letters and correspondence and all kinds of stuff.
And he had kept all that because he thought of himself as possibly.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, he'd been saving every scrap of paper since time immemorial because he thought he was going to be basically one of the great men, capital G, capital M, you know. So on the one hand, it was outrageous and ridiculous, some of the stuff he kept. I mean, there were catalogs for like a couch that he bought in 1972. I mean, it was just anything that was related to him he kept. including every day in the 70s, he'd have his secretary type out the to-do list of what he had to do that day, and he just had stacks of these. So you could just go day by day through the 70s and see what he was doing. You know, for a reporter or a researcher, this was like the proverbial drinking from a fire hose. There was just so much material there, and it was often telling a much more complicated story than the ones he was telling about what actually happened between himself and certain rock stars like John Lennon or Mick Jagger. And to me, that was interesting, trying to marry his version of events with all these other interviews and this archival material that I'm reading or telling, not quite meshing stories, you know.
Did you find those differences to be in just the everyone's own personal idea of their truth?
Absolutely.
Or was there a mythology he was aiming toward?
A little, well, his mythology is his, you know, self-image. Rolling Stone is so much about the mythology of the rock world as crafted by Jan. And if you were in his pantheon of social friends, the Mick Jagger, Yoko Ono, Bruce Springsteen, Bono, you are going to be treated very differently than like Steve Miller, who Jan hates and who hates Jan. There's a whole thing there. So Jan, of course, thought of himself, you know, he's at this late stage in his career. The Rolling Stone, the magazine, is on the way, and he's now selling it as we speak. And he wants to look back on his life through a certain lens, which is natural, you know. But add to that the fact that he is a man of all, and I'm trying to choose my words carefully here, but giant ego. And he sees himself as I point out in the afterwards my book, he as a model for this biography, he said, you should look at the Woodrow Wilson biography. And I was like, well, Jan, it's kind of different, you know, president of the United States, you're like a rock and roll magazine editor, but, you know, that's Jan in a nutshell. And so, you know, that's what you're dealing with. And it's interesting and complicated. And it, what has happened since, you know, Jan, as people will can read about in the papers, he doesn't like the book. And a lot of that has to do with some of the cognitive dissonance, I guess you would say, of like what he wants the book to have been about and what it ended up being about.
His ability to compartmentalize his professional and his friendships and deal with the same people and expect them to not take any umbrage at the professional leverage that he may have had on them. Not a whole lot of people can come out of that unscarred. And it seems like Mick Jagger is probably the person that could understand business is business and friendship is friendship.
Well, and they had a very kind of, you know, a volatile partnership that was up and down through the years. But they were both pragmatists. And Mick Jagger's a businessman, you know, more so than a lot of other rock stars.
London School of Economics.
London School of Economics. And to me, the story of Jan and Mick Jagger is one of the more kind of fascinating and amusing stories, because as soon as Rolling Stone magazine started, a lawyer for Rolling Stones, the band, you know, sent a cease and desist letter to Jan saying, you know, you're exploiting our trademark for commercial benefit. Stop publishing. Destroy all copies. You're done. And, well, of course, Jan, this is like kind of the fast and loose underground rock and roll world. Jan sort of just sent some letters back saying, you know, you don't mean to do this, do you? Come on, be cool, be groovy, you know, like this sort of hilarious letters. But and you didn't see Rolling Stones, the band, in the magazine for the first like 10 months of the existence of the paper, because Jan was living under threat.
Well, it's also ironic that the Rolling Stones took their name from
ridiculous to begin with, because actually Jan took the name from the Dylan song, Like a Rolling Stone. So, but it gives you an idea of what is going on here with the egos and the money. And so flash forward, Jan wants to start a British Rolling Stone. He wants to take his magazine to Britain as well. And he's told, hey, you're not going to be able to do that because the Rolling Stones are not going to let you publish that magazine in London. And so Mick Jagger has an idea. He meets with Jan for the first time in Beverly Hills. They're sitting in like a mansion eating pizza. And Mick Jagger says, well, how about this? We start a British Rolling Stone and I own half. And so this is the solution here. And Jan, he acquiesces to this, although he tries to kind of say, how about it's 50-50, but I have control of it. And and he also sends Mick Jagger a paper saying, give up on the trademark thing. And, you know, you're not going to sue me. Sign a paper saying you won't sue me. And Mick's like, no, I'm not going to sign that. I'm not going to give you the rights to the name Rolling Stone. And I'm going to control it. And so there's a British Rolling Stone starts, and it's Mick Jagger's magazine, basically, with Jan's, you know, logo on it. Mick Jagger just lets a groupie run the thing, and it runs it into the ground. Jan is really upset because his magazine is turned into a laughingstock, and they're misspelling people's names on the cover of the magazine. It was this big disaster. And the beauty of this story and the kind of Shakespearean moment here is that the British Rolling Stone, run by Mick, collapses like a month before the Rolling Stones are about to play at Altamont. Now, if anybody who knows anything about the sort of history of rock and roll knows that December 1969, the Altamont free concert that the Rolling Stones threw in San Francisco, where Rolling Stone magazine was headquartered, was this epic disaster, and it was considered the end of the 60s. A man was murdered like 15 feet in front of the Rolling Stones band while they were playing. And so there's this amazing moment where the whole staff of the magazine Rolling Stone comes to Jan and says they're afraid because they think he's friends with Mick. They're like, we got to cover this. This was like the worst thing I've ever seen. Grille Marcus, the rock critic, said it was like the worst day of my life. It was like all his dreams about rock and roll came crashing down at this concert. It was a disaster. And Jan has a decision to make. Am I going to like nail Mick Jagger's hide to the wall in my own magazine, or am I going to let it go because he's my friend and former business partner only a month before? And he makes a decision and he goes, you know what? We're going to cover it up and down this whole disaster and we're going to lay the blame. And they publish a huge expose on Altamont and they blame Mick Jagger for the entire thing. And it's just like, wow, that's amazing. And it was really the moment that Jan comes into his own as realizing that I can do great journalism in my magazine. And he wins his first national magazine award for that article. And I just think, wow, the poetry of that could not be more amazing. It's just kind of incredible, right? About the, there's the trademark, there's the partnership, there's the failed partnership, and then there's the revenge. Right?
Personal betrayal begets reward.
Yeah, it's amazing. Back to Mick Jagger being pragmatist. Within 9 months, he forgives Jan and says, but I want you to put me on the cover for a new movie I'm in. And Jan does it. And of course, they're going to have this kind of up and down. And eventually in the 80s, they have lawyers get together to decide who can use the trademark when, because both of their businesses have grown. And he's saying, you know, Jan can't have Rolling Stone perfume. You know, that's out of his territory. That'll be ours, right? And he can only do print magazines and books, and we're going to do other products. You know, this is how it became.
Now, we could go through like a chronological recounting of the story.
Sure.
I think that would be a typical way to do it. But I think we should look at the personal relationships as kind of the touchstones of his life and his career.
Right.
So let's start off with his parents, mm-hmm. Edmund and Sim Winter. How did their personalities and relationships with Jan orient him toward a life searching for affirmation via celebrity and notoriety?
Yeah. In so many biographies, you know, you're looking for the rosebud. What's the thing that made him who he is? You know, Jan always said that he was the first child of the baby boom. You know, he's born in January 1946, which is considered the beginning, and he was right there. And he always thought of himself as like the avatar of his generation, you know, a guy who represented all of their aspirations and their revolutionary ideas and everything that was great about them. What's amazing about it is that it's kind of true that his life was almost like shockingly in keeping with everything that did happen with his generation. His pediatrician was Dr. Spock, okay? His parents, when he's born, move to California to start a baby formula business to exploit the baby boom, and they get rich. So it's like he really was hitting all the marks, you know, as he went. But his parents, one of the kind of secrets of the family was that the mother, before Jan was born, had an affair with a woman. And it turns out she was a lesbian, but she didn't want to live as a lesbian. So she marries this man, Edward Wiener, and they have Jan. And Jan, his birth was consummated by to try to seal the marriage. That was had a rocky beginning right there. So then they moved to California, and that marriage is not going to last. But they start this baby business. The mother kind of entertains literary aspirations and kind of ignores him. And he's desperate for his mother's attention, and he acts out. And he was a terrible child by all accounts and got kicked out of every school he was in, and he was violent. But shrewd, smart kid, really smart, almost like a, you know, ADD they would call him now, right? Just he had attention deficit problems and really smart, but too much going on in his family. Well, the bottom line is he's 12 or 13. His parents divorce. They pack him off to boarding school in L.A., and that's the end of the family. They send all the kids to boarding schools, his two sisters, and the parents are incredibly unhappy with each other and fighting all the time. And the lonely 13-year-old is now in a boarding school in L.A. that has all children of celebrities. And there's an amazing letter that he writes to his mom, or exchange that he has with his mother, where he's telling her about dancing with Liza Minnelli at a junior high dance. And she says, "You sound very impressed with them." Of course, he was, because suddenly this was his family, this sort of like boarding school, high school scene. And he was very disliked there, too, at first. In fact, his teacher called him Knox for obnoxious because he was so grating. But he sort of figures out, if I'm going to be popular and get anybody to like me, I got to figure out a new way. And he'd already kind of had showed interest in newspapers. And he had a newspaper, a neighborhood newspaper, when he was 11 before he went to boarding school. So he kind of like gets into journalism and takes over the yearbook at the high school. And this is going to be his way of social climbing in a way. And by becoming the guy who can, you know, shapes the social world at his high school. And that's how he becomes kind of popular, right? And this becomes the blueprint basically for his life. Now, let me just flash back for a second to the mother. One of those fascinating things that I discovered was she wrote a dime novel in the early 60s called Daisy. She wanted it to be like a Peyton Place, kind of like a social novel, but it turned out to be kind of like more like lurid. And the publisher said, no, this is like a dime novel.
Pulp.
It was pulp. But the whole plot of it was that there's all these couples living in suburban Northern California who are all swingers. And they have a club that's like where they all start, you know, mixing it up. And Jan goes and picks this up at the bookstore and he's reading it and he's like, oh my God, this is my parents and all their friends. And it was like very thinly veiled. And he's kind of mortified, especially when he reads the end. Because the very end of the book is the figure who is his mother has had a kind of botched abortion and been hospitalized. And the husband comes to see her, the husband who is his father in the novel. The wife is looking at him full of resentment and dislike for this man. And the final sentence of the book is that she pulls a gun out from next to the bed and blows his head off. And so Jan is just completely traumatized by this book. So, you know, this is setting the tone for somebody that is going to be, you know, going to have to survive all of this sort of psychological stuff. And his survival has a lot to do with how he reinvented himself in high school and going forward. But he was desperate for his mother's love and he doesn't get it. And, you know, not to get too psych 101 about it, but it's pretty obvious. You know, this defines who he becomes.
Now, if you were to put Edmund and Sim on the cover of Rolling Stone, What do you think the caption or the title text would be?
Oh, dear. You know, sympathy for the devils. I don't know. I mean, they, you know, he was distant from them, really, after that. He never had a close relationship with his parents. In a way, you think of Peter Pan, no parents, just living out any fantasy. He happened to have been part of a generation and a time. The reason that the counterculture of San Francisco was made possible is because there was a lot of money and a lot of kids. You know, there was the baby boom and all these, you know, cultural cross currents are happening, but the free speech movement at Berkeley, for instance, which is sort of the first shot fired, that this new generation is going to demand power and have a voice in the world, right? Because what it was the students were saying to the faculty at the University of California, Berkeley, they were barring them from speaking politically or having political literature circulated on campus. And they were saying, no, we should be able to do this. And of course, there was all this sit-ins and protests, and they were protesting for civil rights, but also the free speech. Mario Savio, who was the leader of the free speech movement, had a famous speech, you know, on the steps of the student union. And he was saying, you know, if we want change, we have to take control of the machine of society. You know, put your backs to the wheels of society and take over. And in a way, is what Jan ends up doing. He takes over the press. We're going to have our own press about our own culture, our own real rock and roll world that was bubbling up out of San Francisco. And rock and roll was really the first expression of power of this new generation, you know, because before music had been this teeny bopper thing, you know, for teenage girls to scream and everybody get excited. But now they were going to be like, it was the drugs and the politics and the kind of philosophy of liberation. And so in this renaissance, Jan builds and makes Rolling Stone. And if you see it, the first Rolling Stones, and you compare it to anything that was going on at the time, it's so much more straight looking than anything at the time. It was almost like he made a paper that was accessible and looked professional and had kind of the feeling of newspapers that their parents might have had, but it was all about stoners and stuff inside.
Well, and there are a couple of people without whom Rolling Stone wouldn't exist. Let's look first at Ralph Gleason, who was the music critic for the San Francisco Chronicle.
Yes, and he was a noted jazz critic, been involved with all the kind of most famous jazz critics in New York back in the 30s and 40s. I mean, John Hammond and Ahmet Erdogan and all these sort of famous figures of jazz and record world. And then he moved west at one point to live in San Francisco, and he became kind of the patron saint of, like, you know, rock, I mean, music criticism in San Francisco, had a music column, and was the first sort of, you know, he was in his 40s when the rock and roll thing came around, but he advocated for rock and roll. And Dylan was sort of, and the Beatles were kind of like a, you know, while other jazz people were like, what is this teeny bopper music, has three chords in it, it can't be serious, right? But Gleason said, no, this is real. Dylan's a genius. We should pay attention to it. And so in San Francisco, he was considered, like, you know, their advocate, right? The biggest advocate in town writing for a mainstream newspaper was saying rock and roll was real. So he became kind of like a Socrates-like character, you know, like everybody would come to him. All the young kids would come to his house out in Oakland, and he'd show them records and, let me show you, kids, teach you about Lenny Bruce, or let me teach you about Duke Ellington. And, you know, he was kind of the wise man. And so Jan was one of these kids that went out to his house and kind of sat at his feet and learned. So he also knew about publishing, because not only did he have a column in the paper, but he had run a magazine called Jazz and Jazz Quarterly. So when Jan got to the point where he was going to try to start Rolling Stone, he went to Ralph Gleason's house and said, I have this idea. And Ralph said, well, here's what you got to do. You need to go to a printing press, get an office, find somebody to do it, you know, yada, yada, yada. And basically Jan just follows his instructions, and he sets Jan up, and Jan's got all the energy. He's like this little speed freak, and he's just doing it all. And that's how it all begins.
I'm sure it's just a coincidence, but he meets a woman named Jane Kinner. And Jane Kinner is so similar to Jan Winner.
Yes.
When you see it spelled out,
yeah,
it almost seems like narcissism way as well.
Jan has, you know, is a narcissist. Now, Jane Kinner wasn't, that was a girlfriend he had in college. But that's interesting, because one thing you'll notice is that Jan had a girlfriend in high school who he thought he was going to marry, didn't work out. He dated many girls in the sort of socialite scene. He was a socialite. You know, he was into the debutante balls and
the cotillions
and everything. And that's all, a lot of the kids that he ended up knowing in Berkeley in the 60s, they were those sort of kids of wealth who ended up all kind of migrating down to the Haight-Ashbury. And Jan kind of follows them into that. It's like there was a thing happening, and it was a social change. And they were like, well, we're not going to wear these tuxedos anymore. We're going to go put on Fringe and take LSD. And so Jan's like, sure, I'll come. You know, that's how that all went. But the girlfriend he had in high school and this woman, Jane Kinner, you're talking about, both became therapists, psychotherapists, you know, like, and which I thought was interesting. And they both sort of diagnosed the Jan that they had known. And they were like, it was all about the mother. That's what they kept saying. It was all about the mother, you know, and how she didn't, you know, treat him right. And also he was full of this unvarnished ambition, like the most ambitious guy they ever met. Flash forward, he meets this woman, Jane Schindelheim. And Jane Schindelheim is the woman who would become his wife. And interestingly, after the scene I just painted of Ralph Gleason helping Jan make the magazine, Jan needed money. And it was Jane Schindelheim's family who forked over a large chunk of the dough that he needed to get the magazine, to get the new, at the time, a newspaper, off the ground. And her father, Dr. Schindelheim, was a dentist. And so all the money that really made Rolling Stone possible came from dentistry.
Well, and it's strange because Atlantic Records was also started with money from a dentist.
And I mentioned that in the book because I thought that was really funny when I read that. Exactly. That was family dentist for the Erdogan brothers. So Jane becomes an instrumental figure in the history of Rolling Stone, in its foundation, and onward for the next three decades. And I just will say this, that from the outset, I knew that to get the true story of Rolling Stone, I had to get to her and get her side of the story, which had never been told. And she'd rarely given any interviews in her whole history. But everybody I talked to, they were like, Jane. Everybody liked her. They were attracted to her. They thought she had a lot of keen judgment. She was the one who had maintained a lot of their friendships in their career and lives. And she was a kind of unknown and difficult to quantify part of the formula for the success of Rolling Stone.
How did you get to her?
Well, Jan advocated for me. He said, I mean, he didn't want me to give her as much credit as I probably did in the book, to be frank. But I just kept bugging her, really. I mean, it took a year and a half to get her to talk to me. And I kept telling her the same thing. I told her what I'm telling you. I said, you are incredibly important to this story, and you need to, if you want credit, this is it. Well, I told her what I think is true. Nobody's ever going to write about this again. This is it. This is the book. The book is about to be written. Do you want your story to be understood and your contribution to be understood? And I know she did. And I know now because she spoke to me eventually, and she was very candid, funny, and you could see the charm that she had. And, you know, in the ways that Jan could be kind of capricious and, you know, he was always like a butterfly, you know, going around pollinating the flowers or whatever. He didn't stay in one place at one time, and she really maintained relationships with all these key figures in their life, Hunter Thompson, Annie Leibovitz, Yoko Ono to some degree, other people that they became pals with. A lot of them were attracted to her for all kinds of reasons. She was incredibly beautiful, and she was just funny and interesting to be around.
Well, she had grace and style where he was all rough edge
That's
of ambition.
Right. Exactly. That's exactly it. And she becomes like the salon host for their kind of private social world all through the 70s. A lot of it is based on like kind of drugs and hanging around at their house in San Francisco. They lived in this beautiful Victorian on California Street in San Francisco, which became sort of the headquarters for all kinds of misbehavior.
But as you read through the story, you see that his mother's life lives out through him again with his relationship with Jane and the way it ends up with him coming out in the 90s.
Well, yes. And the funny thing is that his mother always said that he's the most conservative person in our family, she always said, which is sort of hilarious. People would always say that his mother was way more libertine and kind of liberated than he was. And she became a pretty wild person and got involved in these weird kind of like free love communities. The mother did, wore like muumuus with nothing underneath them. And she was always just like way too free for Jan. Jan found her incredibly embarrassing and he couldn't really deal with it, which is ironic. He was the editor of Rolling Stone magazine, but he found his mother to be. But, you know, if that's your mom, it's a little different than other people, you know. And she was just very overly sexual in a way that kind of, I think, made Jan uncomfortable. And she was transparent. She was like, in the late 60s, she was like, I'm a lesbian, you know. And Jan was not going to do that because he knew correctly and sadly that if he were to be out in that way, which he didn't want to do, he would never have been socially mobile enough to be as successful as he became. That becomes sort of a subplot to the book, which is that how did Jan kind of cope with the fact that he was gay? Well, he dealt with it in a way a lot of people did back then. They had a marriage that had some kind of, if not explicit, then implicit understanding about, you know, and since it was the 70s, it was easier to get away with things. It was at one time kind of in vogue to be bisexual in this sort of wild rock and roll world, right? And Jan had no problem with that part, turns out. So.
Well, and his mother was on the vanguard, the precursor of the me era.
She was on the vanguard, totally. As I say in the book, she wasn't a good writer, but she wrote a book called Back Away from the Stove, which was like this sort of feminist story about how they started the baby formula business and how she kind of resented it and breaks away from the husband. She advises women in the book, don't even raise your children. Just go be free. You know what I mean? Just like let the kids get raised by nannies and then raise enough money to have them psychoanalyzed later, she says. She's like, you don't have to be stuck with all the housework. You know, and in a way, it was like this sort of undercooked version of the feminine mystique, you know, by the Betty Friedan book that sort of established this some of these feminist ideas. So she's a fascinating character. She's both kind of horrible, but also pioneering, you know, and sometimes those things go hand in hand.
But it was the reaction to that that brought us to this point of helicopter parents.
Yeah, well, that's interesting. And, you know, later in life, Jan, and maybe surprisingly to a lot of people, but became very interested in having a family. Like he was really into having kids and having a family because I think that he didn't have it as a child and he really wanted to have it. And of course, he was going to try to have it with Jane Wenner, his wife. And that made things even more complicated in some ways because she wasn't really as interested in kids as he was. But he saw it as part of the what you did when you arrived to the age he was at that time. And it was the 80s. And now you were going to be a yuppie, right? And you were going to have your fancy cars and your nice house and have money and a family. So he made a family, right? And today, not to leap too far ahead, he has that family, these sons from that marriage, and now he has three new children by a new marriage to a man. So he really is like, I call him in the book, the polymorphous paterfamilias. If he can have his cake and eat it too, he does. And that's Jan Wenner in a nutshell.
How much of that is just desire for legacy?
Well, I've seen him around his kids. He's decent with them. He is weirdly old school and he believes in corporal punishment. And he's like sort of shameless about it. It's very weird when you're talking to him about it. But he's not an evil person, you know, but he is selfish. And, you know, you could make the leap that he's just about legacy, but I wouldn't want to go that far. There is children. He seems to – they didn't come out badly, the children, so he did something right, you know.
He has these complicated relationships with the two most important women in his life, his mother and his eventual wife. Beyond the normal sexism of the time, how were women treated in the Rolling Stone organization?
Oh, terribly. I mean, it was really – there's two levels to look at it on, how they treated female artists in Rolling Stone magazine, which was horribly, and then how they treated women inside the magazine. Well, initially, women artists like Janis Joplin and Joni Mitchell were just treated so horribly that both of them eventually refused to talk to Rolling Stone. There was an amazing letter I discovered from a pioneering female rock critic named Ellen Willis, who was the pop critic for a New Yorker in the 60s. She wrote a letter to Ralph Gleason, the co-founder of Rolling Stone, just saying, I refuse to write for Rolling Stone because of how misogynistic they are and how they treated women. And she, you know, kind of in a way foreshadowing everything even we're talking about today, was saying, oh, the white privilege of these guys who pretend that politics isn't important and that it's all about, what's it, bread and circuses. You know, it was like that you guys just want to have a lot of fun. Well, we like having fun too, but not when we're getting treated like this, and we need politics to kind of assert our rights. It was an amazing letter because it was 1970 this letter was written, and Ellen Willis went on to be a pioneering feminist herself in the 70s. And in the mid-70s, all these women were working at Rolling Stone in these like very kind of low-level jobs like secretaries and receptionists and everything. And this one managing editor came in the mid-70s. They all had formed a feminist group, these women, like a feminist kind of like conversation group. And he elevated them all because he saw that they were actually doing all the work. They were actually copy editing.
And they had like PhDs.
Yeah, they had postgraduate degrees and they were really smart. And he elevated them all and they became like the core of the Rolling Stone staff in the mid-70s because all the men were so high and drunk all the time they couldn't even get their stories in on time. And so the women end up moving up. And Jan saw, it was easy to see, it was transparent that these were talented people and he needed to give them power and he did. And the two most powerful editors at Rolling Stone magazine from 1975 until 1980 were both women. So he made the top editors women in the late 70s. They had a great legacy there. And I asked both of them, is Jan like Wenner a sexist? And they were like, no, he didn't care as long as it was doing something for him. You know, if you were helping him get where he wanted to go, then he was fine with it. And that was his worldview, you know. So
Rolling Stone not only covered celebrities, but they had the ability to make celebrities. And one of them being a woman who got to work, Annie Leibovitz, the photographer.
Yeah. So Annie Leibovitz was going to the San Francisco Art Institute in the late 60s. And she was like this military brat. Her father had been in the Air Force. And so she, you know, sort of this very unformed, kind of awkward woman who, you know, discovered the camera on a family vacation to Japan. And it became the perfect thing for her because she was – you're talking about – she's like 6 feet and maybe over tall, very awkward, big Coke bottle glasses, somebody who felt – a little bit frightened by the Haight-Ashbury counterculture that she discovered when she came to San Francisco. And the camera kind of gave her a way to be both outside and inside at the same time. You know, perfect kind of journalistic posture, you know. She arrives, she's like a little bit like, you know, I'll take pictures, you know. But she was incredibly talented, especially at kind of developing pictures, it turned out. In fact, when she showed up to Rolling Stone with a bunch of pictures to see if they'd want to print them, they were like, look at how beautifully these are printed. You know, they didn't even care about what was in them. It was like a picture of Allen Ginsberg smoking a joint. That was her first public picture in Rolling Stone. And so she shows up, but she's ambitious. And I mean, this book at its core is about ambition. Jan's, but the ambition of the entire generation. And all of these people that Jan discovers, the thing that cues him in to the talent is how ambitious they are. He would always give ambitious people a chance. And that was a thing that Jan Wenner did. And so he noticed her ambition, it was easy because he was got to go interview, get the biggest interview with John Lennon that he ever had or would have. And she came to him and said, I want to shoot the cover. He said, okay, as long as I can own the negatives and you have to figure out how to get out to New York to shoot him on your own dime. And she said, I will. I'll fly out there on student fare. I'll sleep on couches because Rolling Stone was having financial trouble at the time. So she goes out and she meets John and Yoko. She takes their pictures. These very important interviews that ran over two issues in Rolling Stone in 1971 both had Annie Leibovitz pictures on them. Now, the funny thing about it is the first one is a picture. First issue has just a picture of John Lennon's face. He's got, you know, the iconic glasses and he's got a bit of a beard. It was a light meter reading that she had done. And then the rest of the contact sheet were all these other pictures, like dozens of pictures of John Lennon. And Jan's like, no, I want this one, the light meter reading you took at the very start. And she was very upset about it. But, you know, so much of this was just accidental. It was serendipity and accident. And, you know, here she takes this picture. She didn't even mean to be the good one. And he picks it. And that's the iconic cover. Well, anyway, I would say her entire career was defined initially by her success at Rolling Stone. Through working there and coming to understand that rock and roll world and be just immersed in it, and coaxed along by Jan's ambition, she comes to kind of redefine what it even means to be a rock star. Her big thing was getting them to take their clothes off. Jan obviously enjoyed that. That was part of his sensibility too. And the first real inflection point for that was when she gets David Cassidy from the Partridge Family to pose naked on the cover of Rolling Stone. It was amazing because I found all this correspondence in Jan's archive about it, and he's about to publish – he sends out a press release about it because he's so excited that he got this picture. It's like – because basically David Cassidy had decided, I want to get rid of my Partridge Family career, much as pop stars today do, and reinvent myself as like some kind of adult, right? So obviously Rolling Stone was there for him and says, oh yeah, we'll make you countercultural. Take all your clothes off. And he does it. But Annie in her correspondence says, oh, I feel really uncomfortable about this. This just feels really tawdry. But Jan's like, oh, whatever, you know, we're doing it. And he prints it as a centerfold in the middle of Rolling Stone in homage to Playboy. But that really set the tone for the 1970s and what she would end up doing, which was getting pictures that felt really intimate with the rock stars that everybody loved. And the way that the rock stars were going to get a lot of attention, not only for themselves, but for Rolling Stone, and be considered authentic, was to show more skin and to confess more in the interviews. And as I make the case in the book, the youth culture of the 60s, celebrity got reinvented around it. And, you know, if you went to the mid-60s, the Rat Pack were not taking their clothes off for magazines, and they were not telling anybody anything interesting in the interviews. That's not what happened. You know, celebrity had been a much more contained kind of prescribed thing. And as you got to the 70s, it became about more spiky gossip, more intense confession, less clothes. And this was the revolution that was wrought by, you know, the 60s youth culture.
And that was still managed in a way with the editorial control that he gave some people. Yeah. But you can see its continuation to the social media age now.
Oh, yeah. Well, I made that case, yeah.
Yeah, it's not enough to be good at your job. They want to own your soul, too.
Yeah, right. Well, and, you know, eventually, flash forward to 1975, Mick Jagger and Keith Richards, they just take their shirt off. It's fine. They don't care. That was what you did anyway if you're a rock star. You just didn't have a shirt on and it was all like sexy and free. I'm sure the drugs helped kind of loosen things up as well. And she had huge drug problems, Annie Leibovitz, because she got so involved with these rock stars, both in relationships with them but also doing a lot of drugs with them. She was just embedded, really, you know, to use that word, with these rock groups in a way that she was just in with them. And that eventually took its toll.
Well, and she was a kindred spirit to Winter in ambition and drug abuse, but also fluid sexuality and
yes.
Spendthrift ways.
Oh, absolutely. She did never keep a hold of a dime. In fact, there's a funny moment in the book where they got so frustrated with her. She was spending so much and destroying cameras and leaving rental cars at the airport and parked out front. You know, she just was irresponsible, basically. And eventually they got to the point where they took her credit card away and they just would give her envelopes full of cash and be like, okay, you're going to make it or not, you know, this is all you get, you know, and that was where it arrived. And she was always getting loans and, you know, and that's why eventually Jan sort of puts her under the management of his wife. And Jane becomes basically Annie Leibovitz's friend and kind of quasi manager and some say lovers. So this becomes a whole soap opera that kind of happening, a subplot, if you will, of the book.
Now, if many of the staffers had to take into account Winter's impulsiveness in running the magazine and trying to channel him and focus him in ways and not do everything that he had an idea for, how did then Winter deal with someone even more impulsive with him, like Hunter S. Thompson?
Right. Well, that's one of the most fractious, passionate, interesting relationships, is both of them are trying to get the better of the other all the time. They have a sense of that they are brothers in this, you know, that they are partners in this incredible success that they had, because Hunter became famous writing for Rolling Stone. He became synonymous with Rolling Stone in the 1970s. And Jan was sort of like the straight man to him, who Hunter was always like trashing him and saying that he was cheap. And they would do this publicly almost like as a dog and pony show. But under the surface, some of it was very real. The real sort of tragic element of it is that, and this was shocking to me, I've known who Hunter S. Thompson is for a long time, and I read his early works that people know, Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas and so forth. What a lot of people don't, I don't think I didn't understand, was how short his career actually was, his actual productive, successful writing. At Rolling Stone, maybe 3 years, 3 or 4 years, and then he burnt out. And he went into a drug spiral, basically. And
just coasted on legend.
He coasted on legend, really, almost for the rest of his life. He produced pieces over the years, but they just weren't as good. They didn't hit like that initial one was. And in a way, a lot of these things are cautionary tales about getting really successful early and then not even, you know, peaking early and not ever able to kind of reclaim it again. So it got into this thing where Hunter, when he started to lock up as a writer, and it was because of drugs, especially cocaine, he's watching Jan's success go up, 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 up as Jan finds other writers and other people to come into his sort of circus, you know, and he resents it. He's not only frustrated by his own creative kind of losses, he's watching this guy who he had kind of like partnered with in all of this success, his success run away and get bigger and bigger and him get richer and richer. And this becomes a kind of a fractious part of their relationship about Hunter resented Jan's success. And undergirding that was Hunter's own frustration with his inability to write anymore. So you kind of watch that. And again, the drugs, you know, a big part of this book and the story. Some people think these drug anecdotes are just like a fun to read about, but not that meaningful. Not true. They're central to what was happening in the 70s. They thought drugs were going to, you know, make them more creative, make them more interesting. That freedom itself was an end and not a means, you know what I mean? And eventually, if you get to the late 70s in my book, I mean, it's really dark. Everybody's a drug addict. And, you know, Jan kind of is, but he's able to power through because he's just got this fortitude, you know, that entrepreneurial fortitude, whatever it is about him that can kind of power through. But he's also crashing into a lot of walls. You kind of just see that everything's become decadent. Watching that happen over the course of there's a whole section in the middle of the book called the 1970s. And as you watch it, it starts out fun. You know, you want to be a part of that. And by the end, you're like, I don't want to be a part of that. And it was fascinating to see it in the writing process, to watch it happen.
And she doesn't have like a section dedicated to her, but there's a name that comes up all through that period, and that's of Lauren Gonsalves. She keeps the magazine running, to be euphemistic.
Yes, exactly. Well, so I, just as an aside, funny thing, I just had a book party in New York and I invited a lot of my friends, and I was going to read a little excerpt from the book, and she showed up. And she's a lovely woman and really kind of an amazing person, a very kind of like, has a very non-nostalgic view of that time, which if you're a journalist, that's the kind of person you want to talk to, somebody who can kind of just tell it like it was, you know. Of course, the drug dealer would be the person who could tell you like it was, you know. But yeah, she had been a former secretary to the Steve Miller Band in the late 60s. She goes to work at Rolling Stone. She has a little like family inheritance of like $10,000, and she invests it in Rolling Stone. And it kind of gives her a permanent role in the lives of Jan and Jane Winter and in the Rolling Stone magazine. And she was smuggling cocaine and marijuana in conjunction with a guy who was in the Steve Miller Band. And this becomes like the source of all this partying in this little social world. And there's a picture of her in the book, actually. She was close friends with Jane. And of course, you know, if you're a reporter, she was a great source. You know, she knew everything that had happened. And later, so fascinating, in the 80s.
The furniture.
Yeah. Oh, there's the furniture too. Yeah. Okay. So Jan had a console made that had a mirror that pulled out for snorting cocaine off of it. I mean, this is how deep it got. You know, they were committed to their drug use. You know, the furniture, it was even for drug use. But Laurel, the drug dealer, later went to business school at NYU. And then when Jan tried to buy back everybody's shares in his magazine, all these people owned little chunks of it because he'd sold it off or paid people in shares in the company. He tries to buy it all back so he can consolidate his ownership. And this is when he was about to get very rich in the 80s. Everybody takes the deal, but he was really lowballing on the value of the company. And Laurel Gonzalez, the former drug dealer, says, no, that's not right, and sues him. And this lawsuit goes on for 10 years, and she gets $2 million from him. And so there's this kind of long tale of history here. You know, starting in the late 60s, she comes to work for them, is their drug dealer, but later on actually owns a big chunk of the company, 3.5%, and ends up suing him to get that money from him. And it's like – it's a wild story.
In opposition to the wildness of Hunter S. Thompson, we have the way too young and way too earnest Cameron Crowe.
Yes. Yes, yes. Cameron. Well, you know, a lot of people have probably seen Almost Famous, which is a glorious movie. I really love it. You know, Jan Wenner has a cameo in it. He was this kid. He lived in San Diego, lived at his mom's house, was writing for a local paper called the San Diego Door, came upon some gossip one day about Kris Kristofferson and called up Rolling Stone, and they put it in. Random notes, unnamed, but that they started throwing him assignments. Later, they learn he's 16. He's still in high school. And this becomes kind of a thing they decide we're going to advertise. This is great. We got this 16-year-old kid who's like writing rock criticism and doing profiles of like the Allman Brothers, you know. The bottom line is he becomes a star there because he was a fan like Jan. And in the mid-70s, a lot of the other people that worked at Rolling Stone were already tired of rock and roll. They were already sick of it. They thought it was over. I mean, imagine that. Here we are today. People still love rock and roll. But in 1975, a lot of the critics and the people that wrote for Rolling Stone were jaded already. They were always like, oh, the music's not any good anymore. What happened to the Beatles? It used to be better. But along comes Cameron Crowe, and he was part of the renaissance of like, now we can hire younger people who still like it. And we'll write about bands like Deep Purple and Jethro Tull, who all their critics hated. But of course, he was a kid, and he's like, I love it, so I'll go write about it. Yes, he was innocent, but he was not unsavvy. Cameron Crowe, which the book shows, that he was learning as he observed. Jan and another guy who Jan was business partners with came up with the idea of let's send a reporter back to high school to infiltrate a high school and find out what the kids are talking about nowadays. Because Jan at this point is like 30 and no longer knows what's going on in youth culture because he's too rich and hanging out with this jet set and he's disconnected now. So they send Cameron Crowe back to high school for a year to hang out and just find out what's going on. And that becomes Fast Times at Ridgemont High, which starts out as a book. And Jan wants to turn it into a movie himself because he had just started a film production company, Winterhead. But Cameron instead partners with Jan's like biggest rival, who was the manager of the Eagles, Irving Azoff, who became the executive producer of Fast Times at Ridgemont High, and he betrays Jan. And there's this wonderful kind of like everybody's on the make, you know, trying to make a movie, trying to make a book, and it's all, you know, everybody's exploiting their access to this rock and roll world.
Stay in my ski house. Get out of my ski house.
That's right. Oh, there's that whole amazing sequence. Yeah, where Irving Azoff, the manager of the Eagles, he says in the story that Jan was trying to smoke hashish off of his stove and left the stove on and burned the roof off of his Aspen ski lodge, which Jan claims never happened. And so these guys, till this day, still fighting over ridiculous things that may or may not have happened in the 70s.
So you didn't consult the Aspen fire department?
I could have done an investigation on that one, but it seemed like a sideline. But it was just funny to have them talk, you know, calling each other liars in the book instead of trying to get to the bottom of it. But something did happen and they fell out. But the real reason they fell out is because Irving got that movie and Jan was mad that his buddy had run off with the movie. And eventually in Rolling Stone magazine, Jan starts dropping all these negative stories onto the manager of the Eagles to try to get back at him. And it's just endless petty squabbles between egomaniacs, frankly.
And a softball game.
Yes, exactly. The Eagles versus Rolling Stone magazine. They had a big softball game in the 70s.
He's acting kind of as a mentor to Cameron Crowe, but he gets a new mentor for himself with Ralph Gleason fading back and then passing away.
Yeah.
Ahmet Ertegun, right, who we mentioned before, the head of Atlantic Records.
Yes.
And they together screw a guy out of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Yes.
In order to make it.
Well, this was a story that I had heard about from somebody a few years ago. And they said, oh, you ever hear the story about how they stole the whole Rock and Roll Hall of Fame from some other guy? And I was like, no, I never knew about that. You never read about it. And if you went to do like a search for articles on the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, you would never find the story. I couldn't believe that nobody had really gone into it before. So somebody told me, oh, go look up this guy, Bruce Branwyn. And I went and I found him and I called him and interviewed him. And he told me the whole story. He said, I made the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. A friend of mine who was an ad agency guy came up with the name. It was originally supposed to be called the Kings and Queens of Rock and Roll. They changed it to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. They trademarked it, or, you know, got the, and they made it into a nonprofit organization. They made a board. Bob Dylan's lawyer was on it, and they came up with a trophy, and they were going to make it into a pay-per-view show because Bruce Branwyn was a pay-per-view producer. Well, the one thing they needed was to have the rock and roll record company guys be involved so they could get the artists. And, well, what happens is they get Ahmet Erdogan, and Ahmet Erdogan recruits a bunch of other record business guys, including Jan. They conspire to basically take the entire thing from Bruce Branwyn. Bruce Branwyn sues them, and they settle out of court, and they got it. They got the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And the most amazing thing is Jan's lawyer, who was on the board of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, said, yeah, we took it from him. It was easy. He said that right on the records. I put it in the book. And I just like, you guys. And that's why I sort of described them as like a rock and roll mafia. You know, these record guys were not messing around. They were not always great guys. It was a rough and tumble business, and there were literally mob guys involved back in the 60s. Fascinating to see them kind of tapping into their roots, you know. This was a world of payola and all kinds of bad behavior, and, you know, back in the 70s, cocaine and hookers were like a way that you got a record on the air. I mean, this was a world that was notorious. So this same kind of group of guys with this big, long history, by this time, they're all rich, powerful guys. The record business has been consolidated into a few corporate things. They take over this thing and they turn it into an institution. And the truth is, Bruce Branwyn probably wouldn't have turned it into anything good. They did know what they were doing. And Jan, to his credit, executed a lot of that and made the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame into a thing. A lot of people go online, put in Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. People have lots of passionate feelings about the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, you know, whether it's good or bad. And they all blame Jan for being like this secret gatekeeper of who gets to be in and who gets to be out. And there's a lot of like acrimony, and anybody go online and check it out. You'll see it's pretty funny.
Well, if you take the praise, you got to take the blame.
That's right. He says, no, no, no. There's a board. There's votes. You know, we nominate people based on a very strict system, but nobody seems to believe that, including the rock stars. They all think that Jan puts his friends in and keeps out people he doesn't want in. It's hard to know how true that is, but we do know this. A lot of the rock stars, like John Bon Jovi, campaign to Jan to get in. They see him as the guy. If I can get Jan, then I can get in. And you can make of that what you will.
Now, the last major relationship we'll talk about in the interview is with Matt Nye, the man who was important enough for him to come out about his sexuality to the world.
Well, Matt Nye was this like kid from the Midwest, one of 10. Father was a machinist or something. It's in the book. He was a smart guy, but himself ambitious, moves to New York to go to the Fashion Institute and study design and fashion. But he was incredibly beautiful. Okay, let's not mince words. He was like this incredibly beautiful, fashionable young man. And he gets in with the sort of like gay power brokers of New York and circulates in that world and is sort of seen on the arm of these powerful men like David Geffen and Calvin Klein and these people. And there was this gay social world that people referred to as the Velvet Mafia. And Jan socialized with these same guys, but on the margins, because he was married to a woman and he had to kind of like keep up appearances and he didn't want to get too close to that world. But it was more like a world of gay men who had a lot of power and would hang out on yachts with, you know, kind of living like male rock stars did in the 70s, but for their own interests. And that's where Jan meets Matt Nye, on one of these yachts, Barry Diller's yacht in St. Bart's in like 1994, kind of falls for him. And it's right at a time, though, when all of these gay men are starting to come out. There was a movement to out powerful gay men because some other gay critics were like, how can you hide in the closet and make it terrible for us when there's AIDS and all these things happening? And so slowly but surely, all these people are coming out. And so Jan decides his moment has arrived. He announces to his wife that he's leaving her for a man, and she's devastated, just totally devastated. One could argue still not over it, frankly. And it's a real tragic moment in the book, actually, and it was difficult to write, emotional.
Why did it take them like 16 years to finally divorce?
She wouldn't give him a divorce because she owned part of the company. She didn't accept it. She was in denial, is to be really frank about it. 10 years later, she would be having lunch with somebody and say, when do you think he's going to be over this whole gay thing? You know, she would say this to people. She just didn't believe it because they had been so symbiotic for so long. They had been partners in Rolling Stone. They had navigated their way together through so many social changes and interesting things. I mean, all through the late 60s, the 70s, the 80s. I mean, they had seen it all. And all their friends were super famous, rich people who gravitated to them and really gravitated to her. You know, she was deeply involved with their social world. So for them to break up was not just the two of them. It was this whole social world they had. A lot of Jan's friends resented him for breaking up with her. Even the gay men, they were like, well, why didn't you just keep it up as a European marriage, they would have called it. You know, like one of these aristocratic marriages where it's sort of open and we can all pretend that it's fine. And maybe Jane probably would have gone along with that, actually. But Jan says in the book, I didn't want to live that way anymore. I wanted to be open and free. I wanted to have what I wanted. And so he does it. And it has a lot of ramifications.
Now, it's interesting, as we record this at the beginning of November, that a few people who are later in the run of the magazine have become headline fodder here just in the past few weeks, Tony Podesta and Matt Taibbi.
Yeah. Oh, interesting. That's interesting. Yeah, Taibbi is coming under some fire for sexual harassment. Is that right?
Yeah, from his time in Russia.
And from his time in Russia, right. Well, there was a lot of bad behavior when he was involved in that magazine. The Exile was the magazine. It was sort of a gonzo magazine of its time in the late 90s when there was a lot of excess happening in post-Soviet Moscow. And Tony Podesta has always been like a fixer. You know, he's always been in political kind of like plumber of some kind, you know, like dealt with deltas. In the book, it's funny, he was the one who helped Jan move Rolling Stone from San Francisco to New York in 77 and later helps Jan procure an adopted son. You know, went through an agency, found Jan an agency, helped find a son. He's got like these are just bit part cameo in the book. But interestingly, his brother, John Podesta, was the campaign manager for Hillary Clinton in 2016. So, yeah, well, all of this is to say that this is a very small world that all these people have existed in for the last few years. I mean, the world of power, regardless of politics, really is like much smaller than people can even imagine in Washington and New York and the corridors of those of the East Coast, but also in L.A. I mean, and they're all sort of jet-setting around and talking in the same bubble. You know, as an aside, I remember going to the White House Correspondents' Dinner maybe like 15 years ago. Bush was in office. It was packed with like press, politicians, and celebrities from Hollywood. And I remember seeing Ben Affleck and Donald Rumsfeld posing together, just smiling and beaming, you know. And you thought, well, that's really kind of weird, right? What a weird world we're living in when that's possible. But the truth is that Jan Wenner in Rolling Stone magazine helped pioneer some of that fusion of celebrity and politics back in 1976. Even earlier with 72, and they were part of the McGovern campaign. When McGovern ran against Nixon, McGovern collected around him all the youth celebrities. You know, Jack Nicholson and Warren Beatty and Rolling Stone all supported him. Flash forward to 76 when Carter runs for president. Rolling Stone threw a gigantic party for the staff of the Carter campaign and were intimately involved with the Carter campaign. It was this huge, epic party. The Washington Post wrote a huge column about it, and it was wall-to-wall celebrities. You know, Warren Beatty was there, and the head of the Washington Post, or who else was there? Lauren Bacall, and they couldn't even get in because it was so packed, and there's all this scene of, like, famous people sitting on the curb outside of Jan's party. But anyways, it was like a considered, like, the ultimate fusion of celebrity and politics, and that was a thing that Rolling Stone did, you know, pioneered, and it became a thing that was just part of the culture eventually. So in that orbit, you're going to get people like Tony Podesta. But to Taibbi, what's interesting about that is we're now learning that, you know, powerful men, you don't even think of him as powerful in running a little newspaper in Moscow, but you know, sexual harassment is part of this book and is a part of the history of certainly rock and roll. But lots of instances we're seeing now, it's very common. Harvey Weinstein, in his defense of himself initially, said, I came up in the 60s and 70s, he said. That's how it was, you know, the sexual harassment. It was part of the culture of these companies. And everybody just was horrified when he said
well,
that. But
well,
it was kind of true.
It's true.
It's very true.
But it's not good.
It's not. It's terrible. And, you know, you see it in the book, too. There's a whole sequence I have about this. And Jan was sexually harassing people, too. You know, kind of in a – people took it kind of not very seriously, you know. He wasn't, like, aggressive about it that we know of. But there's – one guy in the book says in the early 70s he had been kind of harassed by Jan and quit. And he said, Jan fancied himself the polymorphous perverse William Randolph Hearst and claimed to have slept with all of his employees. You know, at least that was his sales pitch when he was attempting to sleep with you. You know what I mean? But back then, it was just considered part of the culture. It was the Mad Men world, right? But now we're sort of seeing the curtain is being ripped back from that. It's all kind of being heavily politicized now. So I don't really have a verdict about it, but...
You mentioned earlier that Rolling Stone is up for sale, and Jan Winter had already sold a couple of his publications, Us Weekly and Men's Journal, to David Pecker, who owns the National
Enquirer
and a lot of the supermarket tabloid type things, who's been very pro-Republican, anti-Democratic in this most recent election.
Pro-Trump.
And that's more accurate, pro-Trump. Yeah. And with Rolling Stone having been – they had the more reactionary side of Hunter S. Thompson come through and PJ O'Rourke, but mainly stalwartly lefty in its orientation.
Mm-hmm.
How a lefty publication could be bought by someone that is so pro-Trump is – I don't think it fares well for America.
Well, let me tell you, during the election, I was writing the end of this book, you know, the last third of it. And of course, that was on my radar constantly, what was going on in that election. And I was having to think about, you know, having just in my writing come from the 1960s all the way through the next few decades to this moment and asking myself, how did we get from there to here? How is it that he is the kind of manifestation eventually of the baby boomer story? Because he's the same age as Jan, exact same age. And he's a part of our culture. He was born out of the celebrity culture of television, reality TV. That's how he got famous. That's where people know him nationally. Before that, he was a kind of a curiosity of New York City, you know. But he came out and it was through that. And around the time that Trump became really well-known and popular with The Apprentice was when Us Weekly, Jan's other magazine, began to be hugely successful. And Jan got extremely rich off of Us Weekly. He was making $90 million a year in profit off of Us Weekly in the mid-2000s, like 2006, 07. A lot of people who had been at Rolling Stone over the years were horrified by that. And some people were like saying, well, see, that's what Jan was about all along, celebrities. Raw, bare bones, gross, kind of toxic celebrity culture that was born out of that stuff, that Us Weekly, and of which Donald Trump emanated from that as well. So anyway, during the election, a lot of people who are friends with Jan started calling me and saying, you know, whenever I hear Donald Trump talk and look at him, it's not like I think Jan is politically aligned with him, but he's a lot like him. You know, they thought of them as similar and they were like narcissistic personalities, they would say. This is not people who were enemies of Jan that were telling me this. These were old friends of Jan's who he was still on boards with and stuff, you know, who knew him and liked him even. You know, but they couldn't not notice. And as I thought about where we had come, how did we get from John Lennon on the cover of Rolling Stone in 1967 to Donald Trump today? And by the way, when he won, the next five issues of Us Weekly all had the Trump family on the cover. Beautiful pictures of them, pro-Trump issues of Us Weekly under Jan. Meanwhile, in Rolling Stone, they were doing negative versions of it. And I thought, well, here's Jan in a nutshell. I mean, Jan's an opportunist. Yes, he believes in the democratic vision and he crusaded for democratic policies through Rolling Stone. And it was to his benefit socially. He wanted to be around those people. But now we arrive to this moment where, okay, well, if Trump's the guy, I can. And I asked Jan, how could you put Trump on the cover of Us Weekly? He goes, well, it doubled sales. That was his answer. And then he sells it to David Pecker, who's a major pro-Trump guy. I'm afraid that that is not good for Jan's legacy, frankly. If he can't have his cake and eat it too, he's out there saying, oh, Rolling Stone, we were part of this great social movement and we fomented all the great ideals of our generation and we freed everybody. But it's just didn't turn out to be true, right? I mean, maybe it was true here and there for different people and there were obviously social progress in the last 50 years, a lot of it great. But then now we're here. Now we're with this guy.
Yeah, but you saw Winter wouldn't put black artists on the cover of Rolling Stone because they didn't sell well.
Well, that's right.
And it was a mercenary decision.
Well, the bottom line's the bottom line, right? And, you know, listen, that's why at the end of the book, and I'll tell you the story, the backstory here is that Jan had a secretary for 20 years. Her name was Mary McDonald. She's now the secretary for Bruce Springsteen. And the editor of Rolling Stone Will Dana, who's since been, you know, left Rolling Stone, but they used to talk about Jan. They'd be like, the question was always, is he 51% good and 49% bad? Or is he 51% bad and 49% good? And this was the question with Jan, which I thought that's really an amazing kind of summation. And it could be said about really maybe a lot of people and maybe all of human history. You know, you just say, is it mostly good? It's mostly good, but by one percentile point, you know. But anyway, it was like, and at the end of the book, that's the last, you know, not to give it away, but at the end of the book, I talk about this because, you know, yes, Jan did, he made a lot of people happy. You know, he made a lot of people feel good about themselves. People were fascinated with these rock stars. They were fascinated with the culture. He churned the culture. You know, he was a maker, right? But was he himself a good guy? Not all the time, you know, maybe not even most of the time. And he was selfish, and he represented some of the selfishness of his generation and of our culture, which the thing I always say is that Jan was the me in the me decade. He was a man of the 70s. He represented all the hopes and aspirations of that great celebratory decadent decade. Well, the me decade, that was Tom Wolfe's coinage for the 70s, was followed by another me decade and then another me decade and another me decade. And now we have the me president. That's what Donald Trump is. He's just a big me, you know, and everybody can see it. It's obvious to everybody who looks at him that he's a selfish person and only cares about attention for himself. And he's turned the entire media into just one big mirror to him because they make tons of money just talking about Trump all day long because everybody wants to hear about it. Everybody's gawking with their jaws hanging down. What's he going to say next? What terrible, horrible thing is he going to say next? And that's the world we're living in. Well, that world was created by the celebrity culture, in my estimation and in the book. And he is a creation of that. I'm not saying Jan Wenner is responsible for him, but he was one of the pioneers of the culture we're living in.
Now let's turn the me to you.
Yes.
What have these last few years been for you? I mean, how's covering Jan Wenner changed you as a person? I mean, what effects has it had on you and your personality and your emotions?
It's been really difficult at times. I mean, there's the pleasure of getting to interview all these interesting people, Paul McCartney and Bruce Springsteen. It's great, but managing Jan was very, very complicated. Managing his expectations, trying to go to him and get him to respond to stuff he might not want to face. You know, you're not talking about a guy that spent a lot of time reflecting on his life. So I'm doing all the reflecting for him. And in a way, what you're reflecting on is a guy who wasn't always somebody that you admire, you know, and writing that much about somebody you may not find admirable at every moment was a process that I had to go through and think about what this book's going to be about and kind of shifting it to be less about how, you know, listen, he did some great things and I give him credit for the things he did, but he's also emblematic of what our culture is and was and has become. And in a way, I had to do that, and that was complicated. Let me also say that I'm, you know, I have three children, and I'm thinking about them, and then I'm thinking about him, and it's just universes apart, right? So I was sort of grounded in that way by my children and my wife, who's also a writer and has complicated feelings about Jan. It seeped into every aspect of my life, really. Besides that, the other thing that kept me grounded was the fact that I'm a huge music fan. And one thing I figured out pretty early on is that I love music way more than Jan Wenner loves music. He loves music. He's a big fan. He started a music magazine and he pays attention to it. But like I probably listen to like 10 times more music than Jan Wenner listens to. And I had to kind of compartmentalize a little bit about this book isn't about music in a way, you know. If you go to your bookstore and you look on the shelves of all the books about music, you know, over the years, they've all become hagiographic to say they've become, you know, it's all myth and nostalgia at this point. The Jan Wenner story does not let you do that necessarily. And in a way, I saw, oh, you know, what I'm going to do is scrape back all of that nostalgia and write about what it was really like. Because if you looked in Jan's archive and in his correspondence, it wasn't like they were nostalgic then. You know, they were full of all this like prickly ambition and they were trying to get theirs. And it was all this kind of ego stuff, and which is the kind of the churn of a culture, you know, in real time. On the one hand, you're loving the music and you love the Stones. You love the Beatles. But have you ever read an interview with John Lennon from the early 70s? Not a pleasant guy. You know, in some ways, it's like you don't want to know, you know, about some of these guys, you know, because there's them in their lives and there's the music you love. One of the complicated things was like, I love all this music, but some of these people and their behaviors and some of the stuff they were a part of is unpleasant, to say the least.
So what's up next for Joe Hagan?
I don't know. I just have to get through this book, promoting it and maybe taking a break.
Have you heard more stories since that you'll have to put in the paperback?
Yeah, well, I mean, he's about to sell Rolling Stone. And I think the story of our falling out may have to be a part of the end as well. I mean, that's a postscript here, is that after Labor Day, I sent him the book. And he'd wanted to read it earlier, trust me. He'd campaigned to let me read it before I turned it in to the publisher, and I told him no. And which was hard to tell him no. Like, you want to talk about what it was like for the last 4 years? It was really complicated and nerve-wracking, frankly, to go be with him. And, you know, here's a powerful, charming guy. You know, the founder of Rolling Stone magazine is like, let me see that manuscript. I'll make it better. And you're like, I can't do that. You know what I mean? To maintain that wall, it was difficult. But so anyway, he saw the book. And then he went radio silent on me, and then he canceled an event we were supposed to be at, and you know, the writing was on the wall. And since then, we have mutual friends that I've just developed through the course of writing the book who tell me what his feelings are. And you know, he's hurt. He's hurt. But he's hurt right now in his life, and I think he's at a vulnerable stage in his life. I imagine he's been in this business for 50 years, and he's about to sell. That's not an easy moment. And then to have a book come along that's like the warts and all version of his life, probably kind of hurting him, you know.
And how is that guilt affecting you now?
Well, it's an interesting question. It's not easy because, you know, if you're a journalist, your job is you get everything. Any way you can, really. You're just like trying to absorb the entire story. You interview people. You form relationships with them. But then you pivot and you walk into a room and you shut the door. And then it's you and the reader. And the good writers and the good journalists that I've always loved are the ones that they can shut that door. It's a hard door to shut, to be, you know, extend the metaphor here.
And Winter pivoted and shut that door many times himself.
Many times. And I knew I had to turn, and my compact is with the reader. I'm going to tell you the real story. And I knew if I could, people would respond to it because I was as amazed by it. And Jan's story is huge. The man lived a huge, big life. And I do think at the end of the day, when his emotion comes down a little bit, he'll have sold Rolling Stone and moved on to another phase in his life. I think if he reads this book later, he will come to realize that it is actually the best possible legacy is to have the true story. You know, not the one he might have wanted that carved him in stone and made him into an, you know, some kind of like kind of soft focus hero, which would have been not real in the way he would have wanted, that nobody would have read that book. So I do think the book that is real and true that people want to read about is a good legacy for him. And you talk about guilt. Here's why I don't feel guilty. Because I devoted 4 years of my life to telling the true story of his life and giving his life as much vividness and energy as it was when he lived it. I thought about that a lot. I thought about, like, have you ever seen Mad Men, the TV show?
I didn't watch it. No.
Well, it's a great TV show. And what was great about it was it was unvarnished. It showed you what it was really like to live back then. And because I had such great material, I realized I could actually write a book that took you in, made you realize almost like in a serialized drama what it was like to live back then and be there. And, you know, that people would be engrossed in it. And that's different than writing about it as if it's all historical, you know, 20,000 feet in the air, writing at it as like, you know, a stentorian historical thing about Mick Jagger and Jan Wenner were such great men. You know, this is the kind of book that he might have liked to write, but that's not a book that's not rock and roll either, right? Rock and roll didn't take itself seriously when it was at the beginning. It was just wild kids, you know? And yes, they had ideas and they were idealistic, but it needed to be as wild as they were and show it. To me, at the end of the day, I think he will come around and see this. And I do imagine there will be a day when we will patch it up.
But how do you feel about that personal pain you may have caused, even if temporary?
I feel bad about it, but I do feel bad about it. I feel bad for him. How could I not? I followed him from the day he was born until this moment, page for page for page for 540-odd pages. You know, that's a lot of work. That was a lot of my hours. So, of course, I sympathize. Like at the end of the book, I hope that if you read it, you'll see that I try to bring some sympathy to it. But I also realized that imagine if I'd written the book from the point of view of feeling sorry for him. That would have been not a book. That would have been a bad book. When I started this whole thing 4 years ago, none of this was happening. But I wanted to write a book from the point of view, I wanted to put Jan Wenner at the top of his game and show what that looked like and treat him like a guy who had had power and had been significant and a force, loved and hated. Right? That's the one guy you want to see. You don't want to see the entire story of his life through the lens of an old man that you feel bad about. You know, that's not worthy of him.
Well, Joe, I want to thank you so much for stopping by and spending a lot of time with me. I think I'm going to have to make three shows out of this one.
Well, I appreciate you having me, and I hope it was interesting.
Joe Hagan is the author of Sticky Fingers, The Life and Times of Jan Wenner and Rolling Stone Magazine, which is published by Knopf. I'm Stephen Usery, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at WIPLFM@gmail.com or write to us at Book Talk, care of WIPL, 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee, 38111, or call us at 901-415-2752.
This recording of Book Talk is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license for the United States. You are free to share, copy, distribute, or display and perform this work. But there are restrictions. Nothing in this license impairs or restricts WYPL's moral rights. Thank you for listening to Book Talk.